Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural materials, like leather made from plants, eucalyptus tree fiber, and sugarcane. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're super natural. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com today. That's Allbirds.com.
Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously. This podcast, talking about the Six Nations that has now finished. JB is in his TMO shipping container on a French mountainside. You can hear him talking about everything besides international rugby on the other podcast, which is in your feed, and why you should hit subscribe. I'm Tim, and I'm with Phil. How are you doing, Phil?
Hello, Tim. I'm doing okay. Apart from, I had a slight hangover this morning, nothing too bad. And at 7 a.m, Thomas kicked a full tub of white emulsion paint down the stairs, which promptly exploded.
Oh wow! So I
was hoping to have a little bit of a restful morning, and I had none of that.
It could be worse. It could have been gloss.
You're quite right. I was very sensible keeping the white emulsion at the top of the stairs, not the gloss.
Yeah. Well, you've already taken the shine off of the Dropkick Murphys. But
Sorry.
No, that's quite all right, mate. It's quite all right. But it was only fitting and right that we pay due deference and respect to Ireland Grand Slam champions 2023, world number one team, and just an awesome rugby team, Phil.
They are. A hell of a performance right throughout the tournament, and no matter who was wearing the shirt as well, they were absolutely superb from 1 to 23 and or 1 to 35, depending on how many players actually played. They were awesome, and a bonus point win this weekend again, which means they only dropped one bonus point all tournament.
I can't think of maths now in my head, but it's either five or six tries they conceded in the whole championship, which is incredible.
Oh, yes. Yeah. They're just a very, very good all-round team. And they really are a good all-round team. Like there's no area really where they have any significant weaknesses. The only place that you can, there's two ways to get at them: by scoring absolute worldy tries like France did on a couple of occasions in the first half of that game, or eventually, if you've got a very, very strong driving maul, you can eventually get them with a driving maul if you have enough goes at it.
Besides, like Wales did the other year when there was red cards.
Yes.
That's the other way you can get them.
But even their discipline is generally excellent. Yeah. And I think they're so well drilled that, like, we've seen it. We've probably not seen too many red, yellow and red cards from them, but we've seen them manage totally changing personnel right across the board, to the point where last week they were playing with two loose heads and a tight head scrummaging, and their open side throwing into the line out, and it actually didn't matter. They can just keep going. So I have no doubt that they would. They'd be able to handle going down to 14 men for extended periods of time.
As soon as I saw that team announcement on Thursday, and you saw that pack with Dan Sheehan and Caelan Doris in, and you saw what was the back line that beat New Zealand in New Zealand, even without Gary Ringrose, you thought, this is done.
Yeah. As an England fan, went into it, you kind of have hope. But you don't really believe, and you never really believed. And then, to be fair, in that first half, England. Now, the interesting thing was, England played some good stuff, and they controlled the game nicely. They never really threatened Ireland.
No.
As in the whole game, I think England made one line break in the whole game.
Really?
They just never...
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, they just never threatened. The best attacking opportunity England had, halfway through the first half, England had 14 or 15 phases with ball in hand in Ireland's 22. Right at the end of it, Freddie Stewart nearly got round the outside of Henshaw to create an opportunity for Arundel, but he didn't. And that was the one. It was 14 or 15 phases, stretched them from left to right, deep in the red zone, and they nearly created a try-scoring opportunity. The only other chances were penalties, which Faz kicked well, and the rolling ball try. Ireland's defence was superb.
Yeah, and there was a clear gulf in class between the two teams. But I would also say defence, I think, was the area that stepped up most for England. I agree with you, like the between now and the World Cup. And actually, the good thing for England, and I'd say Wales and Australia and even Argentina, is actually you've got an extra couple of games preparation for having to be good than the other teams on the other half of the draw. So by the World Cup quarter final, England have got to develop their attacking game. But the defence, you've been talking about it, how England have been saying, oh, we're learning a new defensive system. And you pointed it out after the France game that it feels like maybe Kevin Sinfield's defensive tactic is to have a little bit of a passive, soft defence, give up a little bit more space, but not get breached. And it felt like against Ireland, they've actually gone in the week, right, scrap that. Let's go back to quick line speed and just smashing everything in front of you.
Yeah, there was a bit more on that side. There was still a few wobbles, but I think overall it was not bad. But there were a few wobbles. Like there was, it didn't actually result in a try. I think it resulted in the first 3 points being scored. But there was a break down the middle, a Keenan break down the middle after about 20 minutes of the first half, where England's defensive line was all at sea, like totally. It was just dog legs everywhere, multiple dog legs, four of them. Besides that, I thought they did all right. Although the first Sheehan try was poor, and it's a bit structure. It's also a bit of just not reading. I think it was Ludlam and Sinclair, both of whom kind of assumed the other one was going to start filling in that place.
Yeah.
Neither one of them actually did.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking that afterwards. I thought it was actually Don Brandt's hole, but maybe it wasn't.
It might have been.
But the point is, that's one of those where in the team meeting, there's fingers pointing in lots of different directions. It was just poor
from a lot of
angles and not sniffing out that threat. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, you're right. There were wobbles there, but that was the element where they got at Ireland and caused them issues. And Jack Willis was a beast at the breakdown. They were more dominant in the collisions. And that meant that suddenly Jack Van Portfleet had a bit more of a platform to do some good box kicking and Owen Farrell sit back in the pocket and knock the ball around and play territory. And I think the biggest thing is that the Aviva Stadium, all that noise before and when the teams came out and building up to kickoff, just evaporated. It was quiet, deathly quiet when England was 6-0 up.
Yeah, it went away. And then, obviously, second half, Fields of Athenry was being belted out when it became an unassailable lead. When Johnny Sexton slotted the conversion from the touchline for that third try, and it meant it was how many points? There were more than two converted scores ahead. And it was like, that is it. It's game over.
Yeah.
Disappointing for an England fan, but there are some green shoots, but it's all about Ireland. That Ireland team were so good. So fair play, deserving number one in the world, deserve a Grand Slam. And it will be very interesting to see how they go into the World Cup in what is a horrendous route to the World Cup.
Yeah, it really is. Just on England then, like just focusing on England for a minute, what were the green shoots you talk about? Whether it's whether that's individuals, whether that's elements of the game.
I thought the scrum and line out have been good all tournament. The scrum at times, I think England won several scrum penalties against a very good Ireland scrum. And when, particularly when Sinclair and Genge were on, I thought when Tom O'Toole came on, that probably coincided with Vunipola and Dan Cole coming on. I thought Ireland got the upper hand towards the end in the scrum. But besides that, England won some good scrum penalties, and generally their scrum has been better all tournament. Besides that, I thought Watson looked good.
Yeah.
This weekend, with not much ball, feeding off scraps, but his feet were exceptional. I think Freddie Stewart has had a good tournament generally. I think Lawrence, it's a shame he got injured. I think Van Poortvliet getting more game time is good. I think we know now that Faz is going to be the starting 10 unless Ford comes back to some remarkable form.
Is that as you see it? Because this has been like an area of constant debate, the Smith-Farrell thing.
Yeah, I think it will be. I think it will be. I could be wrong about that, but I...
No, I think it will be. Do you think it should be? Is that your read of it? Like your objective read of it?
Yeah, my objective read of it is that both will now settle with Faz as the number one 10. And part of that is just he showed that in this tight game, and even when they were man down, Faz is much better at controlling the game like that. Marcus Smith, for all the amazing things he can do, and he can do amazing things, he's just not, he plays a different game. And that different game works incredibly well in that Harlequins team. It doesn't necessarily translate to international rugby, and it certainly doesn't necessarily translate to international knockout rugby. As you said before, Tim, look at the tens, the type of tens that have won World Cups. It's not Carlos Spencer.
100%. What's just on Ireland, what's great about the Six Nations is, particularly with Ireland's half of the draw, is that they will not get a better replication of what they will need to do at a World Cup than what they have just done over the last 7 weeks. That should fill them with a lot of confidence.
And what they did in the autumn as well.
Absolutely.
Last autumn. So yeah, 100%. They are primed and ready. They've got everything that they need to. They're as in as good a position as they possibly could be, but they could still easily and likely go out of the quarterfinal.
Yeah, quite likely. So I want to preface this conversation by saying I don't believe it affected the result, and I think Ireland's pressure over 80 minutes would have told regardless of this next conversation. So it's not, it may be perceived as sour grapes. It's not sour grapes. It didn't affect the result. However, I'm just going to go to an email here. James Cowan. Hi, James. He's been listening since the very start and said, He's even made sure he's listened to episodes that he missed. Oh no, he started listening in 2014, and we were going since 2013, and he went back and listened to the old back catalogue one. So he's this is like proper stalwart. So top avenue on board. He says it's a lovely long email, James, which I'm sure you'll appreciate. I'm just going to skip to the big question at the end, but I very much appreciate your email. He says so to the subject of my email, please in your Monday morning feed of international review, don't fall foul of the current rugby trend in agreeing this is a red card. The punditry at the weekend on air clearly had to rein it in, but I would love to hear what was said off air. And this is one of the reasons why I listen to your pod. It feels like I'm listening to honest comments on the game. If someone cares enough about the game to listen to a podcast about it, it's pretty obvious they're not the casual watcher that wants to be pandered to in how Stewart deserved his red card and it didn't ruin the game and that it made it more interesting. So please, let's stop dishing out red cards to be in line with. Anyway, you get the point. So James is pleading. Well, firstly, do you think the pundits what do you perceive, Phil? Do you think they do rein it in a little bit?
I think they sometimes do rein it in a little bit. Not all of them, but I think they generally do.
Yeah.
I think Austin Healey's one who generally doesn't. He speaks totally freely in exactly how he thinks. I think many of the others temper it.
So with that in mind, what do you think of the now, Freddie Stewart red card?
So first of all, I totally agree with your point that it did not change the result. Maybe it would have been 3-1 without the red card. Probably not. I think it's the right result. And it would have happened anyway. The red card is very interesting for me because I watched this in Talk H with no sound. And we're chatting away and watching the game as a kind of background. And in that scenario, I think with no sound and we just saw the replays really, we had no one really had an issue with it. It's looked from that like made contact with the head, shoulder to the head with force, therefore red card, comfortable, move on. Now I rewatched the game today and I strongly think it should not be a red card. And I think it's the thing that is incredibly frustrating. I understand why I came to that conclusion yesterday on watching replays with no sound. But I quite strongly think that Jacko Paper did not ask the question that I've seen other referees ask and is crucial in this scenario, which is play it again in real time. Because in real time, you see several things. You see a clear knock-on. You see Keenan dip to scoop up the ball. You see Freddie Stewart, like, totally change his position to try and get out of the way. He's not trying to make a tackle. He's decelerating and trying to protect himself to be so that the collision, if it happens, is the least worst collision that you can make of it. So for me, it's not a tackle because he's actively trying for it not to be a tackle. There is a it's a very dynamic situation. There is a clear change of Keegan's body height and body position as a consequence of the ball going forward and bouncing and scooping to pick it up. Therefore, as harsh as it may be from an Irish perspective, when one of your best players goes off for a HIA and fails it and doesn't come back, I actually don't think it should be foul play because it's not. Freddie Stewart is not trying to tackle him. He's not trying to engage in contact.
You have just absolutely nailed it in that last sentence. I checked this. The protocol that the referees go down, the very first question that they ask, has there been foul play? Before you consider, was there contact with the head? Was there an effort to wrap the arms? Was it with force? All of those questions are supplementary to, has there been foul play? Mm-hmm. And that's where they got it bang wrong, because the protocol, if being followed, should have gone, was there foul play? Let's have a look. No, that is not foul play. Move on. And I agree. And we have to have a place in rugby for accidents and for unintended, non-reckless bodies colliding. You cannot litigate and mitigate for that in every circumstance, nor should you even try to. And when you try to, you just get things which I think in the cold light of day, most people that play rugby or have played rugby, the majority, not everybody, but the majority of people would come to exactly the same conclusion that you and I came to, Phil.
Yeah, and I think another thing that we've talked about in the past is, what's the learning point? Like, if you actually want to change behavior, which you know is a phrase that JB hates, but a phrase that he likes is incentives.
That's why we're told the law changes and all this came in.
Yeah, it is. But if you want to incentivize kind of good behavior, for want of a better phrase, what's the learning, or how do you change that? Like, this is not a behavioral change. He's actually trying to get out of the way. Freddie Stewart, when you look at it in real time, you look at his actions and look at how fast it happened. He is not trying to make contact. He's trying to get out of the way.
And the spill of the ball and Keegan like reaching down to try and pick it up, all of that. You cannot predict these things. So there's this duty of care argument and stuff that, like, Freddie Stewart is a rugby player on a rugby field, and that Eddie Stevens phrase I keep using, the risk is the reward. If there wasn't the risk of accidents happening and someone getting hurt, and I hope Hugo Keenan's well, and I hope he was able to join in with the celebrations and everything yesterday, because he's been absolutely brilliant. But if there wasn't the risk of something like that happening, the game wouldn't be nearly as compelling as it is. So
yeah, I'm absolutely fine with that being, if it should be classed as a rugby incident in my mind. Fortunately, it is a very rare scenario. Fortunately, because it was a horribly nasty collision for Keenan, but also red cards like that are irregular and rare. Yeah. It's not likely, we're not going to see 10 of those a game. No. But it really felt like it was the wrong result. And it will be interesting to see how this is dealt with, because we've seen, like, when Wayne Barnes gave Uini Antonio a yellow card for the Robbie Herring hit, and then that got upgraded to red. We've seen things go that way, probably because there is, and rightly so, for many reasons, there is a focus on head contact. It will be interesting to see what is done here, whether it's maintained as a red card or rescinded, because there will be a disciplinary proceeding on it. That will be a really interesting test case that comes out.
Absolutely. I'm watching that one very carefully. Martin Twigg puts it like this on email, contactedchasers@gmail.com. He said, many will be saying game's gone soft after the steward red card, but it's not the real issue. The real issue is how we allow the interpretation of the laws to give referees the discretion to make a balanced decision based on the speed of the game, or how they don't. You understand the point he's trying to make. I'm not sure the current referee protocols are reflective of or understanding of the game in real time, which is kind of echoing the point you made, which is, and it's when you, it, I understand it in theory makes things more consistent when you reduce things to a flow chart. But unfortunately, when you reduce things to a flow chart, you do simplify nuanced, complex situations, which no two circumstances are the same. So it's that reductive versus specific and empathetic way of viewing it. But the problem is with Jaco Pyper is, if he hadn't have given that, we don't know how. This is why I'm with you, Phil. I want to watch what they do, because had he not given it, he might get absolutely hammered for by his superiors.
Yeah, quite possibly. And you never know. I've seen on Twitter, I normally try and stay away from Twitter, but instances like that, it is interesting to gauge the perspective. And there is a lot of polarization, as you would expect on Twitter. It's not entirely surprising. Mm. There's a lot of people saying, of course it is a red card, you absolute idiots. And a lot of people saying, of course it is not a red card. Or, well, I actually think that the side that is saying it's not a red card is generally a bit more understanding and nuanced than, of course it's not a red card, you idiots. There's people putting forward sensible, logical arguments, like I hope we've tried to. But you still get the people saying, of course it is a red card.
Yeah. Yeah, we will very much see what they do.
Just on the risk piece, did you see the lawsuit recently from women's rugby?
No.
So it's a few weeks ago. Absolutely awful case. Awful. A woman from playing rugby is paralysed as a consequence of a horrendous tackle.
It's like has she been prosecuted as a criminal matter? Is it that one, or am I crossing wires here?
I don't think it is a criminal matter. I think it's I'll send you the judgment. If judgment fascinating, I'm fairly certain it's not a criminal matter. But it's the whole thing, the whole read is fascinating. It's really worth reading. Not least because Tony Spreadbury, former international referee, doesn't do particularly well for the defendant as an expert witness for the defendant. That's quite interesting to read, that side of things. But the other interesting thing is it frames what we mean by risk quite nicely. And I can't remember, it was a few weeks since I read it. I'll share it with you after this, Tim. It's definitely worth reading. It frames what we mean by the risk that we take when we go onto the field. Because the tackle that's made is, so it hinges as whether the case hinges as to whether it was a legal or an illegal tackle. And if it's a legal tackle, you take the risk of playing the game within the laws. If it's an illegal tackle, you don't accept the risk of people doing illegal acts on the field. And it frames that acceptance of risk quite nicely. Like, it seems quite obvious, but you only accept the risk of the laws as they are written, as you go on to play and as you understand them. Like, for example, a really clear example would be if someone puts a crowbar in their forearm guard, they've got a metal bar in there and hits you in the head with a crowbar, you don't accept that risk. That's not a risk that you accept by going onto a rugby field. So that would be clearly both illegal on the rugby pitch, but also illegal in a court of law act. Whereas you do accept the risk of the known laws as you play it. I just thought it was a really interesting case to kind of frame that far better than I have done in my explanation now.
No, I'll absolutely check that out. I will just summarize, just rattling off a couple of things off my head before we depart from Ireland v England. We've talked about how brilliant Ireland were, and they were. I love the different types of players they've got. They've got the real classy ballers, and like just in their pack, you've got Dan Sheehan, who's like a modern 2023 prototype of a player, just awesome. And then you've got Peter Omani, who's so old school and belligerent. And when, because actually there was a lot of defending that Ireland had to do, and he didn't do a lot ball carrying, but he was just an absolute nuisance. I just kind of love those different textures and different characters they've got. They seem to sort of have someone that ticks every type of box. Caelan Doris, just an awesome, like all the hands, explosive. And then you've got these absolute tough workhorses. It's great.
Yeah, it's a really, I've not thought about it in that way, but they have got some kind of extremes. Like Peter Omani, Jack Conan is old school.
Yeah.
Ty Furlong is old school.
Yeah.
Andrew Porter's kind of modern in the fact that he's massive, but he's a more old school player. Whereas Caelan Doris, Sheehan, Dan Sheehan, who's been brilliant, by the way. Sheehan is superb. Van der Fleer in the forwards.
Like Aki McCloskey, and then you've got Henshaw and Ringrose.
Well, Henshaw's probably slightly more of the old school, but he can do a bit of both, can't he?
Yeah.
But like, look at the two wingers. Mm. James Lowe, big and route one with a massive boot, and Mac Hansen, who...
he punches above his weight, doesn't he?
Yeah, I've not always been Mac Hansen's biggest fan because he kept out. He got selected over Robbie Balakoon. And maybe I've held a grudge for a long period of time as a consequence of that. I cannot deny how well he's played, particularly the last 2 weeks. I think he's been absolutely sensational the last 2 weeks. He is a much better player than I probably gave him credit for. Originally.
Certainly than the Brumbies or Australia gave him credit for.
Yeah, fair point. And him and Keenan, Hugo Keenan, they just kind of effortlessly glide and have got lovely hands, whereas someone like James Lowe or Bundy Aki is more route one, more bigger, stronger, more explosive, but very much more one-dimensional.
Yeah. As for England, I hope this puts the Farrell-Smith debate to bed. Whilst England weren't brilliant, and Owen Farrell, actually the attacking game needs a lot of work, I think actually there's a foundation of non-negotiables you have to have, and you have to have a tough attitude, you have to have some rugby smarts, and you just have to be tough to play international rugby. And Owen Farrell not only did all those things, I actually thought he was a fantastic leader in a way that and maybe it needed to see Ellis Genge doing it for an hour last week. and then Owen Farrell do it again in a difficult situation like that to sort of realise that, no, yeah, he is one of those guys that goes and has a little moan at a referee sometimes. And in the past, people have just fixated on that. But almost absence makes the heart grow fonder. And Owen Farrell not starting, not playing in that hour, and then you see him goal kicking and doing all of the fundamentals. And it's just... I constantly talk about how I don't understand the disrespect that Owen Farrell gets, but I think whilst England weren't brilliant and no individual player was much better than their opposite number, if better in any way, Owen Farrell, I think, has shut a lot of people up.
Yeah, I agree with that. 100% kicking this week, which is something that he struggled with earlier in the tournament. And the two moments I loved from Owen Farrell, one was when Dom Brandt bumped Sexton off the ball and Sexton went down holding his head. And Farrell said to Jacko Paper, if he's holding his head, he's got to go off for a HIA. I loved that. And yep, good point. A point that we've made in the past, actually. You've got to stop the play acting. And the other one was when the red card was shown to Freddie Stewart. I don't know if you heard
red
this.
Card? Red he, card?
I could not get Mick Morgan out of my head. You went full of Mick Morgan.
So true. The bit I loved, actually, Owen Farrell gave away the first penalty of the game, but I loved it. Loved it. It was he kicked it up, putting up an under in. Hugo Keenan, Jameson Gibson-Park caught it, and Owen Farrell absolutely... Yes. Wiped him out, and unfortunately, a fraction before Jameson Gibson's Park's foot touched the floor. But we're talking centimeters, so it was like mistimed by a fraction of a tenth of a second. But the Owen Farrell absolutely mullered him, and kind of set him and a big hit from Ellis Genge in the first minute set the tone.
Mm. There was another good hit from Willis later on Matt Hanson. Coming around the back of a rolling mall, popped up and just got nailed by Willis. So yeah, some green shoots. Definitely.
Some lots to do, and there's still some question marks, but we can save those for another day. Was I gonna just show? We've had some cracking emails this week, Neil Bathe, someone who met JB in Dubai, was emailing about that red card decision. I think generally the email seems like, I'd say it's like 90%. Oh yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Let's just briefly talk about the coverage of the Six Nations in general this weekend. Now, I love Nick Mullins, commentator. I would never want any other commentator talking me through my rugby. ITV though, you said you weren't listening. Where you were in Tokyo, it was, they had a bit of a shocker this weekend.
So I did, when I was watching it yesterday, I wasn't listening. Today I've rewatched it and I was listening. I've got to say, I'm not the biggest fan of Lawrence Dallaglio. I'm really not. I thought Gordon Darcy was okay generally, but Dallaglio, I'm not so sure of. And I skipped, because I was re-watching it, I skipped all the pre-match and halftime. So I didn't see Sir Cly. I saw that there was it four? Was it Rory Best, Bod, Johnny and Sir Cly?
Yeah. Now, the issue, there was a few issues I had with it. One, they this is a big occasion, it's a big moment. The pundits were having a chat. And it didn't seem, they weren't like, they didn't sound excited. It was kind of like, let's have a cerebral chat about this. And they carried on that conversation as the teams were running out onto the pitch. So you had the pictures of the teams running out, but the audio you heard was, you didn't really hear the crowd or the occasion. You just heard them sort of having a relatively mundane conversation about tactical elements to do with the game. And it was like, this is such a massive occasion. And this dovetails with, it was Scotland Italy game. I think that there was just talking all over referee decisions. I mean, BBC have done this as well. This isn't an ITV BBC thing. But and then after the game, I know they moved it to ITV4, but the moment they chose to cut away was just before the trophy was being lifted. When they cut to Ant and Dec.
Ant and Dec.
Which, I don't know. I know it's a difficult one, but I don't think any of the broadcasters have particularly covered themselves in glory. We talked about Gareth Thomas being on BBC coverage previously.
And ITV, yeah.
And well,
is
and
he on ITV?
ITV? Yeah, he's on ITV as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, which is outrageous.
Yeah. And then it was one of the games, was it the Italy game, was Italy-Scotland was out of sync. It was like a second out of sync. The commentary and the pictures, they were just, they were ahead of, the commentary was ahead of the pictures. So, but
weird.
The rugby's been brilliant. The tournament's been ace. And what game would you want to talk about next, Phil?
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So I watched... watched the first half of Scotland France, and then the second half I saw while I was in transit to.
Did I say Italy, Italy, Scotland? You know what I meant.
Anyway. Sorry, Italy, Scotland. Yeah, yeah, sorry, oh, yeah, Italy, sorry, Scotland, sorry. Yeah, Italy, Scotland. I watched the first half of that at home, and then the second half while I was in transit. And the last 10 minutes of that game were excellent. So obviously you've got the crash ball 10. Kinghorn scoring a couple of tries.
They are Kinghorn 3 tries, wasn't it?
Well, a couple of tries, and then in the yes. You got, so it's 3-1, 10 minutes to go, but Scotland haven't kicked sticks, so Scotland are only 5 points up, and Italy start turning the screw in the last 10 minutes, and win a few scrum penalties, get some good field position, get close to the line, get turned over, and just had 10 minutes of possession. And then the last scrum, when Scotland have, they've only got 3 tries, but Italy could still win the game. They've got a scrum 5 metres from their own line, and they should just finish it off because they're not going to go 95 metres. But they go for it. They went for it. And they could have thrown an intercept. Scotland could have won that game. But they went for it because they wanted the bonus point to ensure that they finish third. And they scored an absolutely brilliant try. So Kinghorn scored his 2 Route 1 crash over tries and then showed amazing pace to accelerate away and score that final try, which was a hell of a try. It was a hell of a risky situation to do it, and fair play. Even without Finn Russell on the field, they went for it and did it. So I loved that finish. Slightly disappointed that Italy didn't get the win, that their overall performance is probably deserved one win. But it was good to see that finish.
Agreed. I want to be fair to all broadcasters and make it seem not like I had an ITV vendetta. We got an email here from Alan B. Contact headchasers@gmail.com. He says, love the pod, blah. I agree with JB. Have you noticed, as I have, that the BBC commentators have been calling Marisi Menoncello for the whole first half? Menoncello is on the team sheet as 12, but it's definitely Marisi wearing the 12 shirt. I think they've figured it out now, only 60 minutes into the game. It can happen.
It happens to the best of us. We've all called players, people, the wrong names at times.
Yeah.
Or even called the wrong games, the wrong teams.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah. we got an email here just before we... because of the Toc H match. It actually wasn't a conventional Super Saturday where I was, again, partly because Didsbury Toc H do not have their first team pitch next to the clubhouse, so you can be in sight of both a big screen and the pitch, which is very disappointing.
One of the few weaknesses of Didsbury Toc H.
Yeah. Well, that and the pitch is being on a floodplain, so...
Yes.
When they need to open the floodplain, you can't play rugby there anymore. But aside from that, yeah, great club. Got an email here from Charlie, who says, hope all is well on the pod. And commiserations to JB on his recent election results. Check out the other podcast for information on that. Mm. He said, I was watching George Gregan on a recent alternative grassroots podcast, and he rattled off a couple of stories about Byron Kelleher, which were quite amusing. I decided to go on Wikipedia, his Wikipedia page afterwards, and I stumbled across some gold. He's posted us a little picture and says, you're welcome. And do you know much about Byron Kelleher? Other than
I think
he was a massive unit of a scrum half.
Yeah, I think I've read his Wikipedia page before, and there's something to do, I'm going to say, something to do with a niche actress. Am I right? Is that...
Yes. Well, so clearly someone's... Byron Kelleher is both well-known enough that that he has a Wikipedia page that people can edit, and not famous enough that anyone would go and correct the edits that people have made. So Byron Kelleher, maybe it's been changed by the time you read it, so I'm glad there's a screenshot here. It says, during Kelleher's formative years at Otago Boys High School, he was a champion sprinter, obliterating the regional record for 100-metre sprint previously held by Peter Snell. I can believe that's true. Next sentence. Fable has it that before competing his dash, Kelleher outstretched his arms in celebration. Usain Bolt would go on record to quote this moment as the inspiration for his premature celebration in the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games.
So I've just got onto his Wikipedia. So that is actually linked, as in that statement, everything needs in Wikipedia should be referenced. That statement is referenced. I can't believe it will, I'm clicking on his, on the reference to it. There is absolutely no way reference from the Washington Post contains any reference to Byron Kelleher. So let me just confirm that with a quick search. Byron, no, zero of zero references. Yeah. So yeah, that is clearly made up.
It mentions that Kelleher met in 2004 an American adult movie star, Ashley Spalding, better known as Kehlani Lay. They reportedly crossed paths in a hedonism resort in Jamaica, then dated and lived together until they split in 2006. The Independent called them a raunchy antipodean answer to Posh and Beck's. And again, that's got a reference, which obviously is not a genuine reference.
Well, so that one, I have heard that before, and I can't remember if I've just heard it through Wikipedia or if that one actually... I think that one might actually be real. I think, but let's keep... Is there any more from your side?
Yeah, Kelleher's rumoured to have had a torrid love affair with the American pop star Pink.
Now that I find as being less likely. And looking at the reference to that one, or the link to that one, yeah, it just links you to the All Blacks 2007 fixtures.
Oh, there you go. And then,
one is not right.
And then after talking about the Pink love affair, it said Graham Henry actually tested Kelleher for his testosterone levels, as his behaviour in training was primitive and raw.
Again, I suspect that is not real.
And then it says the result of this test showed inhumane levels of testosterone, which led Henry to place Kelleher on the team sheet for the test a day later, off the team sheet for the test a day later, as he was too scared for the well-being of the French. And then Kelleher was dating Julie Noves, the 22-year-old at the time, and daughter of Toulouse manager Guy Noves. What else is there? You see,
I think some of these are real.
Yes,
some of these are not real. That's the best. There's always an element of truth in the best fiction.
He was rumored to have been romantically involved with the Princess of Monaco. I mean, good. He was a good-looking fella and a proper unit. Anyway, there's lots of this stuff. Thank you, Charlie, for that gold mine. I appreciate it.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. There we go. Scotland will be fairly happy. They're the best of the rest, is how they've been described, and I think that's fair.
It's and we actually I remember saying this last year after last year's Six Nations. Then it was France are number one, Ireland are number two. Then there's quite a considerable gap, and then you've got everyone else. And that has not changed. Now France and Ireland have switched round. Now you've got 1A and 1B. Ireland are the best, France are second best, but either could beat each other on their day. Then you've got a long, long way down. Then Scotland are next best, England just about in fourth, Wales fifth, but improving. And Italy, they are in sixth, but again, they are improving.
Yes, agreed. And Italy justifying their place in the Six Nations. There's no one questioning whether they should the promotion, relegation, Georgia, etc. at the minute. And that's a positive, really positive thing for Italy. They're not going to get out of their pool in the World Cup. They've got New Zealand. They've got New Zealand and France. It's not happening. So, just I guess their under 20s are all right, and that's that. Oh, I forgot to mention under 20s. By the way, the Ireland got another Grand Slam, and just showing that they kind of rude health come through. Their back row at under 20s are frightening.
But it's back to back Grand Slams, isn't it? Yeah. In under 20s, that is very impressive.
Yeah, 100%. And then we've got, how do you assess Wales after that? It's a bit like England. There's a lot of people going, oh, they lost, but oh, that's good. And is that where Wales fans' heads are and should be?
Probably. So I think halfway through the tournament, kind of 2-3 games in, I thought Gatland had lost it. I now kind of see his plan, or at least I think I understand that he's got to test all of his combinations and test which ones in a very short space of time are the right ones or indeed still the right ones, because some of them will be the ones that he knew kind of 4 years ago, knew for many years, 4 years ago plus. I think he's probably done that. And also Gatland is a man who he stays in every fight. The Welsh team that he led for years and years and years and won multiple Grand Slams with was the kind of team that would stay in every single fight and never go up. And that is the kind of team that you need. Like, it took him to 2 World Cup semi-finals that he lost narrowly, took him to multiple Grand Slams and 2 successful Lions tours. So I think Wales, they will be in a good place. Whether they're good enough to actually fire a meaningful shot at the World Cup, it's probably, they probably won't be, but they will at least put in a respectable showing.
Well, I think they could quite realistically and reasonably get to a World Cup semi-final, because they're probably, it's not a foregone conclusion by any means, but I'll back England to beat Japan, definitely. And I'll back us to beat Argentina as well. But
yeah, even though we lost in the autumn. I'm with you, yeah.
And then if that is the way it goes, I imagine Wales will probably finish runner-up in their pool, maybe first. So Wales can beat England in a one-off game in a World Cup quarterfinal. Then they're in a semi-final.
Definitely they can. They can beat England, yeah.
And then they showed in the last, against South Africa in the last World Cup, and as you just said, they can stick with any team. Yeah, go on.
Well, the problem they've got is the problem that several teams have, which is they can win any one-off game, and they've beaten teams recently enough to show that. They can't win. I don't think that they can win. Let's just call it quarters, semi-final, 3 back-to-back against 3 of the best teams in the world. I don't think they can do that.
I agree, but having said, Ireland may well not reach a semi-final. I think a semi-final for Wales should represent a big success, bearing in mind where they've been.
Yeah, I would agree with that, actually. That would be a good result for them.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And in terms of this game, from what I saw, watched pretty much all the second half live, been back and watched some of the other stuff. France did what they needed to. They scored some lovely tries. Pernod looking class, Ficou looking class. The Dupont pass for, which try was it? It was Pernod's first try. It was outrageous. And they won this game at relative canter. But Wales, to score four tries away in France, they'll take a lot of positives out of that, because generally they don't, they struggle to rack up the points. So I think both teams will be relatively happy with this result, which is a bit weird considering France put 40 points on them.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of Welshmen that have answered critics in the way that, you know, Owen Farrell would have quietened people. Nick Tompkins has had a load of stick. We like him. And mm-hmm. I thought he was Wales' best player. And he kind of, you're watching it, and it's easy to say that now, Monday morning quarterback, hindsight 2020 and all the rest of it. But it made you wonder why he hasn't been playing before, because he operates in a very good Saracens team. He's never really let Wales down. Some people think recognise he has some limitations in his game, but doesn't everyone. But he's a square peg in a square hole in that Welsh team, and really does a basic job that they need. And so I thought that was good.
He does a good basic job, and he's got a little bit of magic as well. His feet, because he's relatively short and fast, his feet are excellent. He always beats defenders. So I quite like him. But I think it's this... if you'd have asked me last week, I would have said, no, Hawkins and Grady, that's going to be the centre partnership going forward now. Like, Gatland settled on that, and now we're back to... And indeed, Owen Williams. Now we're back to bigger Tompkins North. So
yeah,
I have no idea. I absolutely do not know.
Well, those two, actually, it's a little bit like going where England are now, and also because he's classed generally, but Owen Farrell and an Ollie Lawrence, or maybe even a Manu Tuilagi, there's something to be said for it. Where when you need to just sort of simplify your game and have a foundation to build from, Dan Biggar and Nick Tompkins sounds like not a bad place to be.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then George North as well, cutting some nice lines at 13, doing some good stuff.
Yeah.
If you were going to pick, I know JB would hate this, which is why I'm going to ask the question. If you were going to pick a team of the tournament.
Yeah, go on. We can rattle through this.
We could do it, actually. I was going to ask the question, do you think a single Englishman gets in? I think no.
I think no. I think you're right. I can't think of a Welshman that would get in, or an Englishman.
Probably not. I mean, you're basically picking from, it's half Ireland, half France, with maybe a couple of Scots, maybe Hugh Jones and Duan, and maybe Xander Ferguson. But yeah, that's your team. So shall we do it just to annoy JB?
Yeah, just to annoy JB. So Lou said prop.
Porter. Or Cyril Bai.
Yeah, Cyril Bai only played a couple of games, didn't he?
Did he?
No, he played three of them. He played in that first. Or did he play all of them? No, he played all of them.
I think Tighthead,
they rotated every week.
Because of red cards.
And Cyril Bai has got better and better and better through the tournament. So it would be toss up between him or Porter. I don't mind which.
And that might be the one place where you give a note, an honourable mention for Ellis Genge.
Yes, I agree.
But it's one of those two. Genge isn't getting ahead of those two.
Hooker, did Dan Sheehan do enough in two games to mean he has to get it? I think he did.
I think he did. I think he would be starting for the Lions if there was a Lions test tomorrow.
100%.
And he is. I thought a few years ago when he first started, probably only 2 years ago, I remember him playing against France, and I thought, God, maybe he's a bit lightweight for an international. He's not. He's just class. He can do absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And more. He's one of those like hooker pluses where he does all the basics just as well as anyone and can do more.
Yes. Tighthead prop. I would find this one tricky. There hasn't been a standout tight head prop?
No, I'd probably go for Xander Fagerson, but he missed a couple of games because WP Nell played.
This might be where England come closest, not because Carl Sinclair was brilliant, but because there's no one really that was great.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd pick him, though.
No, I'd probably go for Fagerson.
Yeah, I'll go with that. Tadhg Furlong was only there for a couple of games and wasn't actually brilliant.
Yeah. Finlay Beelan played well when he played. Tom O'Toole played well when he played. I can't give it to any French tight head because of all the bad things that they've done.
Yeah.
All right,
let's go with Xander Fagerson then. Done.
Fagerson.
Second row, easy to pick Thibaut Flamont as one of them.
Definitely arguably
player of the tournament.
Definitely Flamont. Could go for Big James Ryan, who's been consistent without being exceptional.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I'd go with that.
I do like Ryan Baird. But he's not played enough to warrant it, but yeah, I do like him.
He's a very exciting player, yeah.
He is.
So James Ryan and Thibaut Flamont, that feels good. By the way, I didn't mention it in the England roundup before, but Dave Ribbons looked good for England, and potentially to the point that, honestly, if it wasn't for all the incredible games he's had in the past, I think on merit, Ribbons Chessum might deserve to be England's starting locks.
Yeah. Now, do you have any insight as to what's happened to Johnny Hill? Because he was a mainstay for England.
Yeah,
Lions 2 years ago. He's got a lot of experience. He's prime age. And he's not injured. He's fit and playing for Sale Sharks and playing pretty well. It seems for whatever reason, Borthwick does not like him, does not want him, because you've lost your starter, bringing in Ribbons, who is off to France. And so as things currently stand, will not be available post-World Cup for someone with all that experience. So it just seems a bit strange.
It's a great point. And I've no insight whatsoever, no.
Mm.
Put a pin in that one, come back to it. Right, back row then.
Right. Got to have Olivon. Got to have Caelan Doris.
Got to have Van der Flier.
Yeah, you probably do have to have Van der Flier. But then I think Aldrete had some amazing games. I think he was quite quiet at the start.
And was incredible against England, decent against Wales. But yeah, he was poor.
Yeah.
Not poor, but quiet. That's the right way to put it.
He got brought off after 12 minutes against Scotland, which obviously that's not his fault, but it was a weird move.
What was the... that's right. What was the... which one of the Canoni brothers is the number eight?
Yeah, the number eight one.
Lorenzo? I think it's Lorenzo. It's Niccolo and Lorenzo, but I think Lorenzo's the number eight. Him. He was good.
He's really good. That's a good shout. Definite. And honourable mention for Negri and Lamaro, actually.
Yeah.
That Italian back row is good. It's legitimately good.
And Matt Fagerson was brilliant in the first game, but then obviously injury. I'm going Doris at eight, Van der Flier at seven, Olivon at six.
Yeah. Very, very, very happy with that.
All right, cool.
It's laughable to even debate, to even discuss it. So let's just move on.
And just on DuPont for a second. I think we talk about our players world class and they work class. It's DuPont is, he needs to have a subcategory all of his own because he is beyond world class.
Yeah, I think he is. I think he is the single best player in the world at the moment. He might be the best nine to ever play the game, including greats like George Gregan, who you mentioned earlier, and Joost van der Vesteijzen and all. Like, he is outward. He's redefining what a nine should do in almost every single category. He's outrageously good.
And he is not... It's not beyond... Bear in mind how young he still is. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that we are watching the greatest rugby player of all time.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's such a remarkable thing to say. One thing I would be maybe not concerned about, but he plays a lot of rugby because he's so important, because he's so good. You would worry, and he plays every game 100 miles an hour. He's incredibly physical for a nine, which sounds like a bit of an oxymoron, but he isn't. He's incredibly physical. Like, ignore the nine part. He is just an incredibly physical player. So I do worry that maybe he does need a little bit of looking after.
Yes, yeah, fair.
He's a hell of a player. If he's playing this well, like, it just doesn't matter. But you might look back and think, well, maybe we should have protected him a bit more.
Fly half. The contenders are Finn Russell, Roman and Tamak, Johnny Sexton. That's it,
probably,
really, isn't it?
Probably Sexton. Because Wales have rotated, England have rotated, and Italy have rotated because they've had Garbisi and Tommaso Allan.
Finn Russell's been great.
Finn Russell has been great. Although his best bits, I'm sure almost every game that you watch Finn Russell, you could have one of the best highlight reels of all time. You could also have like a Percy Montgomery style or Nick Abandonen against the Tuolagis style calamity reel of almost every game that he plays, because he tries so much that goes so well, and he tries so much that just it doesn't quite work in every single game.
It's very so fair.
I would go Sexton.
Yeah, I'll go with that. Centres, is there a shout here for a dual Scott selection, Tuipulotu and Jones?
I think they should both be named, definitely. Partly because I think Ireland have rotated so much because of injuries. And that's his credit to Ireland.
Dante looked great when he came back, but he's only been back for a couple of games.
Yeah, now I think Fiku should be in there. So I would probably, and this has happened in the past, I don't think he played there in this tournament, but he's played 12 in the past, so I would actually have Fiku and Hugh Jones.
He did play 12 in this tournament.
Did he?
Yeah, I think he played 12 against... Moafana did.
Moafana played, lined up at 12. War 12.
Yeah, so Fiku and Jones, I like that.
They'd be my... Now, 12, here's a point that I wanted to make, and you probably saw the stat... The Yak stat this week, which players made, we call it Yak, yards after contact. It wasn't badged as that, but it was yards in contact, basically. Who made the most meters in the tournament, in the first four rounds, in contact, or certainly from contact having been initiated? Did you see who it was?
I'm guessing it was an inside centre now, so... Big Stew?
No, it wasn't an inside centre, but it got me thinking that maybe he could solve a long-standing inside centre problem.
So it's one of the England... Freddie Stewart? No.
Yes, Freddie Stewart.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I know you've spoken before about moving Tommy Freeman to 12.
Yeah.
What's not to like about Freddie Stewart? Like, England have far more back three players than they do inside centres. It's almost too obvious, particularly when Jordy Barrett is playing 12, playing well for the Hurricanes, and will probably be starting for the All Blacks, as he has done in the past, at 12. And Jordy Barrett is certainly in stature... and ability, not too dissimilar to Freddie Stewart himself.
That's very interesting. This is where I like the Irish model that they've got their game, because when they do have a positional issue, in fact, Robbie Henshaw is the best example of it. He was a fullback when he started, and it was actually the Ireland head coach, I think it was Joe Schmidt, who said to Pat Lamb, "We see Robbie as potentially solving our inside centre issue. Can you play him at 12? Connacht get a bit of money from the IRFU. They're incentivised to try and help the national team. And so Pat Lamb said, sure. and they moved him from fullback to 12.
Yes. Now this would be impossible to do, partly because the clubs are a law unto themselves, but also because actually maybe two of the next four best potential 12s in England also play for Leicester, in Dan Kelly, when hopefully he's not injured, and Guy Porter. So it's not going to happen. So basically what I'm saying is Freddie Stewart needs to leave Leicester and play 12.
I'm up for it. And I want to see Tommy Freeman at 12 as well, for the same reason you said. We've got so many back three players that Tommy Freeman is awesome and not needed. So yeah, play 12.
Now, am I making this up? Didn't Jason Robinson once wear 12 for England?
Oh, he did.
Was it against Italy? I'm certain in about 2006. Yes.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you're so right.
I need to look that up.
Yeah, he definitely. I'm almost certain that happened. Yeah. I think he might have skipped the side when he did that.
Maybe, yeah.
Jason Robinson, inside centre. Let me have a look. Jason jinxed the way to create a new dimension. This was in 2004, post-World Cup win. I'm looking forward to Jason Robinson being offered an above average... blah, 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 blah. Yeah, yeah, against Italy in the Six Nations.
Yes. Yeah. There you go.
Right, so we got our centres picked. So we just got back three to select then.
Yeah.
Damien Penno's on one wing.
Definitely Penno. Penno and Doohan are probably obvious choices. I think Mac Hansen's been excellent.
And James Lowe's been good before, except for the England game. He didn't have a good game against England, but he has been good the whole tournament.
He has been good all tournament. I think the two prime fullbacks in Keenan and Thomas Ramos have both been excellent. Both been really, really good.
Yeah.
Freddie Stewart has been very good under the high ball, obviously, and very good at crash ball. Hint, hint. Play him at 12. I'd probably go Pano, Doohan, and I'd probably go Ramos, but coin toss between Ramos and Keenan for me.
Keenan started brilliantly. Ramos finished brilliantly. I could go with either. Let's go Ramos.
Yeah.
Would you go Doohan?
I think I would do.
Ridiculously good against England. Always a threat.
He just beats so many defenders.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Let's go for Doohan van der Merwe. So our 15 is Porter, Sheehan, Ferguson, Flamon, Ryan, Olivon, Van der Fleer, Doris, Dupont, Sexton. If we're going through the numbers, Doohan, Fiku, Jones, Penno, Ramos.
Perfect.
Love it.
And even better, because if JB's listened to this, he would have hated every second of it.
Exactly that. Hello, JB. We know you're listening. Like that. It's like Howard Stern, which is to say on when he was a radio presenter, that the people that liked him listened for 1 hour a day. The people that hated him listened 3 hours a day.
I love that.
And that's why the podcast has been so good with JB on it.
But yes, incredible.
Phil, that's been a pleasure, mate. I've absolutely loved this Six Nations tournament. It's been one of the best I can remember.
It's fascinating, especially because in the World Cup year, you've always got the looming large what is going to happen in 6 months' time.
Yeah,
I found it interesting listening to Steve Borthwick. God, I can't remember if it was his pre-match or his post-match this week. But the point he made was, he's had so little time. He had a week with the players in January. And then he said he basically, in tournament, he gets one big training session with the guys a week. So he's had five big training sessions. And at times, some of his players, like, for example, Jack Willis, his starting open side for most of the tournament, has been yo-yoing back for to Toulouse or the weekend. So before the weekend before the French game, he was playing in Paris for Toulouse against Racing on the Sunday night. He was then up at 4 a.m. to travel back to the UK, back to England, to Pennyhill Park, presumably. And then only a few days later, back, well, it was at Twickenham, but back playing against Frenchmen.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, that is ridiculous.
And that is unusual for an Englishman to have to do it. Obviously, it's more usual for Finn Russell, for example, or Dan Bigger to be doing that kind of thing.
Indeed. Right. Thank you very much for all your emails, your messages. You can find us patreon.com/eggchasers if you appreciate the fact we're there for you every single Monday morning, 52 weeks of the year. And well, yeah, we'll keep making the podcast. Other people will just pack up shop now to the World Cup, all the World Cup warm-ups. We'll be here for you every single Monday morning. Nice one, Phil.
Cheers, Tim.
Top stuff. Right, I'll get that. I'll get those all uploaded, mate.
Wonderful. Good stuff.
I'm gonna end this so I can get cracking on that now. I'll speak to you soon, bud. Have a good week.
Cheers, Tim. See you. Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.